Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about the 10-year anniversary, 10-year celebration? Wait, what is it? Recovery. The 10-year recovery from the financial crisis, and a lot of the changes that it's wrought. Also, women in FinTech, Ripple's announcement around its new product, and Facebook's efforts to get your financial data. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news.
I will never get tired of that.
I'm going to get you a racket. Like a wooden racket.
We have two.
Yeah. Oh,
I'll
yeah.
just bring them in. Yeah. Y'all True. Can be a band together.
Yeah. We're in the studio. With me today is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Heidi ho.
All right. Our first article is on a New York Times article on the financial crisis.
Yeah, it's actually a suite of articles. So the New York Times had a great set of pieces last week commemorating the 10-year anniversary of the Great Recession. Before we do that, though, where were
the
you?
Great. It was a great recession, wasn't it?
It was a great recession, yeah. Well, it was certainly big and sustained.
Now your grandparents have nothing to hold over you. I lived through the Great Depression.
And, I mean, it was not quite as dire on a global basis, our Great Recession, as the Great Depression.
Yeah. Although just the photos are like...
So far, we haven't needed a world war to get out of it. So that's a good thing, too.
So far.
It's still
so
early. Far, yeah. It's about 10 early. Years, was it? Okay.
Yeah. So the article in the Times highlighted the things that sort of were brought to us by the Great Recession. Things that you really don't think about. All the way, you know, things from...
From
food stamps to eating out of a tin can. No, things like the rise of Bitcoin, the increased prominence of fintech companies, and even the suckiness of the Mets.
Yeah, that was interesting. I remember now that they had troubles meeting their salary, right?
Yeah. We'll go through.
I totally forgot about that.
They ended up getting a bailout from MLB so they could make payroll because they couldn't make their payroll in like 2009 and 10.
Say it ain't so, Joe.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Wow. So this article is actually it comes with a pretty neat infographic, although it's kind of difficult to actually navigate. But it has a few things that I think were brought to us by.
I think it works better on an iPad. Because you can pinch and zoom.
Yeah.
But on a computer, it's a little bit tougher.
Yeah, I looked at it on a laptop, and I was like, oh, you're hurting my eyes.
It's not a zooming in and out and just not a very intuitive thing, which is not usual for the Times. They should have pretty good graphics.
Yes, their graphics are often top-notch.
Yeah. So one of the unexpected outcomes of the Great Recession is that now we have Bitcoin. So as you may recall from 10 years ago, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of mistrust in the banking sector. You know, people couldn't get their money out. There's a lot of, you know, a huge meltdown, basically. And because of that, people really jumped on this bandwagon about DLT and cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. And the article argues that as a result of the recession, we now have this massive surge in things like Ethereum and all the other cryptos and blockchain becoming more widespread.
I wonder if Satoshi Nakamoto lost his house as a result of the financial crisis. And here we are.
Great
question. He had an interest-only loan that went badly for him.
Yeah.
Well,
we can make up
maybe.
Anything because it's nobody knows who that person is.
I was going to say, I wonder what I don't know that I know the effects of the Great Recession on the Japanese economy.
Oh, but the Satoshi Nakamoto is just a pseudonym. Nobody knows who.
It could be a consortium. It could be one guy, sure.
Yeah, right.
One other outcome from the Great Recession is also the rise in fintech. So, of course, because banks were not really lending out all that money in the wake of the crisis with their rates being the way they were.
And their really high credit standards.
That's right, yeah. Then to kind of fill that gap, a lot of the fintech players that we know now was sort of quasi-household names kind of stepped in. So players like Lending Club and Prosper kind of stepped in to fill that gap. Mm-hmm. And that's how we saw this massive uptick in people relying on these online digital platforms to get personal loans.
So now instead of regulated large banks making bad loans, it's small non-regulated fintechs making bad loans?
Unregulated non-banks, which is also another issue that we can discuss later. But yeah, that's a different set of, a different ball of wax, if you will.
Every financial crisis is unique, huh?
Indeed it is.
Even
the one
in 2019.
That's right. One other outcome that the article points out is that also rise in VC funding. So because of the interest rates were so low, there wasn't a lot of money to be made in the markets, even though we've had a bull market since. But essentially, a lot of the money that would have gone into the public markets and ended up going to non-banks like VC firms, PE funds, hedge funds, and so on and so forth. And I kind of fed a lot of the frenzy that we saw around funding in Silicon Valley as investors sought better outcomes.
Yeah, because interest rates are so low.
Exactly.
It drives them to go somewhere else, right?
Right.
Interest rates are low, and whatever whatever effect the financial crisis had on kind of your average Joe, there was still plenty of money rolling around in the world. And also, I don't think the article touches on this, but there's actually been a pretty substantial drop off in the total number of publicly traded companies, period. So that would be another typical place where a lot of investors would put their capital that they haven't been able to. So I think that's another contributing reason that you'd see
pretty
all that
smaller
money going
winners
into VC.
And all the money is going into a few winners instead.
Yeah.
Right, which you see in terms of the VC funding for fintech and private companies as well.
Well, we've seen it in the valuations, right? They're
exactly
skyrocketing.
Yeah. In the valuations,
no,
you see them
no
in,
bubble here.
And getting so much money that they can stay private much longer than they would have typically 10, 15, 20 years ago.
All right.
Great. So now from the anniversary of the Lehman collapse to what could actually bring us on in the next couple of years?
What can trigger the next big financial crisis? Is
right.
that what you're saying, Steve?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Which of the many, many, many problems that we have could trigger financial crisis?
Since we do seem to be due for one, right? It does seem to feel like we're on kind of like, every decade or so.
It's time for a downturn.
We got to find a way to scare ourselves straight again.
Gotta do it, yeah. This is all prognostication and not based on anything concrete. But he brought out the things that could actually also lead us to the next recession. And he has a full list here. The first one is the rise in non-bank mortgage lenders. So if you are at all a podcast listener, which I assume you are, I'm sure you've heard of Rocket Mortgage from Quick Loans, right? Quick Loans is not a bank, but they have in fact overtaken Wells Fargo as the largest mortgage originator in the country. I think more than half of the mortgages in the U.S. go through Quick Loans now, which is incredible.
Yeah, so if you're like a fintech and you're saying, well, someday... Well, we're going to pass the banks. I mean, this is already happening in a lot of areas, right?
It happened in just a few years for them, absolutely.
I feel like the market penetration that Quicken Loans has got in a pretty short amount of time is really striking.
It's a strength of marketing. They're just
it's
marketing
all, ads,
all over
yeah.
the place, right?
And they're actually – they're
is it just the marketing? Because I think also it's speed. You know, they say that they're going to give you your approval or your pre-approval, whatever. You're going to get it within a matter of days. And, I mean, I would assume, although I cannot speak from experience, that whatever their underwriting process is, it's probably a little speedier.
Let's see what happens
so
in the next recession.
That's an issue in the article, actually. They have slightly more lax standards than the banks do, so mm-hmm. that could be an issue that could lead to sort of a meltdown in the mortgage market again.
We don't know what it looks like in a downturn, right? They're a non-bank lender. They have more lax standards. What happens when a big chunk of these mortgages start to fail?
Yeah, that's always the test. They've kind of risen up after the financial crisis, and we don't know.
Risen up after the financial crisis, which that financial crisis was caused in the residential real estate market, and now we've actually seen in a substantial part of the country, housing prices have roughly doubled from a lot of their down market peaks. So, you know, that's just a lot for... That's a lot for a relatively untested lender that's originating 56% of all the mortgages in the U.S. right now. Mm-hmm. That's a lot for them to have to deal with if things go sour.
Yeah, that was the Alan Greenspan approach to regulation in the late 90s and early 2000s was that the financial industry has sophisticated models and they know what they're doing. And
bubble's
going to
bubble.
Yeah. So we see that greed is also a factor that goes into these things, and it's going to override a lot of these protections. But just to be clear, Quicken Loans is not the same as the Quicken Software and QuickBooks by Intuit. That's a totally separate thing. Just FYI.
Just an FYI there. The other issue that's brought up is also shadow banking. So what is shadow banking? It's basically... Entities that operate in the financial market, they're not regulated. So, again, hedge funds, PE funds, and all that kind of stuff. And the argument here is that although...
Square Cash?
What's that? Square Cash.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Square Cash. Sure.
So people that operate like banking functions without being banks.
Right. So, like, PayPal would fit into that thing as well. Yeah, that whole thing. And that market has grown significantly since the recession mm-hmm. ended. When did it officially end? Like, 2010 or so? 2011?
I can't remember exactly when the formal recession ended, but yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
2010 is my guess.
Let's call it 2010. Let's say a 3-year recession.
Because the economy started growing, it just grew really slowly for a really long time.
Yeah, I think there's an official definition, but I like the definition I once heard of
two quarters of consecutive economic growth or economic contraction is typically whether you're growing or in a recession.
So the definition I heard a long time ago of a recession is when your neighbor loses his job, and a depression is when you lose your job. So it depends, I guess, on each person, but hopefully you're not still in a recession or a depression.
So back to shadow banking, we have a lot of these quite substantial, very large firms who have loaned out money, taking in money, have made themselves more intertwined and valuable in the marketplace, but they're not regulated by like banks
right.
yet, and we don't know really what's going on in there.
And yeah, they won't respond to the normal regulatory controls that we have, the policies. So if the Federal Reserve makes a change or changes lending policy or reserve policy, mm-hmm. these shadow banks, I mean, that sounds very nefarious, shadow bank, but right. it's really like just anyone that has money that lends it out or invests or even does things like payments like Square. That's not officially a bank.
Right. So acting like a bank, but just don't have a bank charter.
It sounds illegal or something.
You're doing anything wrong.
Yeah, yeah, the shadow banking. But in any case, since it's becoming so huge, you know, if there's a problem there, there's less that the government and regulators can do about it because they're not connected to the formal banking system, the official banking system.
And do we think that because they are not as closely connected to regulators, does that lack of closeness also mean that they are less likely to be considered too big to fail or not worthy of government intervention or financial support if the times get really rough? I don't know.
Good question. Yeah, I know they hold $54 trillion in assets, which is an insane
around
number.
The world.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a pretty chunk. Yeah. Pretty chunk of change.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see in the article that it was 13% of the global financial system. So that's a big chunk that could go down, right?
But that's only
globally.
And it
could have like a connected effect. So if there's a big problem in, 2 or 3%, that could have knock-on effects, a domino effect in other parts of the industry, financial industry.
It's also a larger chunk of the economy in China as well. It's about a quarter of all Chinese finance transactions are in shadow banking, so... We talked about, I think, two episodes ago about sort of Ant Financial and their whole like massive footprint in China.
Yeah.
This could be this could have a worse effect on China than on the U.S.
Very interesting. Shadow banking. They should get a better name. They should get a name that makes it sound a little less nefarious.
It's more sexy if you say, "Oh, what do you do for a living? I work for
a shadow banker.
I'm a shadow banker." Yeah, sounds good. I want that on my card.
Cloak and dagger, yeah.
I'm going to lend you $10, Steve, so I can call myself a shadow banker.
Do it. You're in the system.
You're a bad credit risk. No. So.
For the record, I have a pretty good credit score.
I guess.
For the record, he does, and we know because he showed it to us.
I did.
Okay.
I like to walk the walk. Walk the walk and talk. Yeah.
I don't think that's right. There's something. That's like. Yeah. Okay. So I love this article because it brings up some really interesting points, like the rise of fintech after the financial crisis.
That's right. So as we know, as we discussed earlier, there was a movement away from traditional banks towards more of the online players, and those have gotten humongous now. So now there's approximately $120 billion of fintech-linked debt for consumers right now, which is a massive jump from $72 billion just a couple of years ago. So,
and some of that is, I guess, the pullback from banks. They've gotten more shy.
They kind of
or the regulators
space.
Kind of... crushing down on them, and now they're filling in the gap, maybe?
That's the case.
Hopefully.
Also, they claim to have better, quote-unquote, better risk scoring methods now, mm-hmm. so more algorithms or whatever, other things to measure, non-traditional stuff. So that's it. So again, this massive growth, and this guy in the article points out that if this sector were to implode, we could be in some trouble.
Here. Oh, that reminds me of another saying from the dot-com bust. It's like, you don't know who's wearing a swimsuit, until the tide rushes out.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So we'll see how good their credit modeling is when...
Who gets left holding the bag when these when and if these fintech-linked debt items go bad?
Great question. A lot of them are actually still private, except for LendingClub, which went public and has kind of shat the bed in the market in the past few weeks, or months rather.
But they're getting institutional money to make the loans, right?
They are, but where's that money coming from?
So it's just my retirement fund.
It's coming exactly from pensions, from CalPERS, from California, and so on and so forth. So it could have ripple effects in the economy and your 401k, but it won't be a direct hit as if they were public.
One of the things that they mentioned in this article is that these fintech firms are actually originating more personal loans than traditional banks, to the tune of about $31 billion for fintech firms. Banks are doing about $22.5 billion, but credit unions are doing $18.7 billion in personal loans.
Not insignificant.
Credit unions don't have nearly as much market share as banks.
I think that's the perception, but I think that there was a big sort of flight away from big banks or credit unions during the recession again. I considered it. I would have gone with one if I had access to one. But I think we can. That's borne out in the fact that they almost have the same level of personal loans as the big banks.
And maybe because there's a lot of smaller ones, many more of them
that
you don't see.
So there's actually been a huge kind of hidden consolidation in the credit union space. So I cannot remember the name, but there's one firm that's been buying up a huge chunk of the credit unions across the nation, but they keep their original branding, so their customers feel like it's still the same local company, but it actually isn't. And I do wonder if credit unions kind of saw personal loans as a place where maybe banks weren't making as many of those, and so it gave them
the same as the tech startups
a place to serve in the market. Yeah.
So where do banks go from now? They sort of seeded the personal loan space to both credit unions and fintechs. Did they just focus now on wholesale banking?
They're already not the biggest mortgage originator.
Right.
So another article related to the financial crisis we saw this week is called "Could Women in Fintech Stop Another Lehman Brothers Collapse from Happening?" And this article focuses on some comments by Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, who says makes some points about how women increase the diversity of opinions and how boards with more female members tend to have better financial results and higher returns for the same amount of risk. Christine Lagarde, she's made this point before, and she's definitely a promoter for diversity and of opinion and against the aggressive kind of capitalism, being French as she is, a more balanced approach towards capitalism in general. And one thing she mentions about fintechs is that greater diversity sharpens your thinking and reduces the potential for groupthink. So we've seen that a lot in Silicon Valley, the boys club, and a lot of mistakes that are made.
So I have a hot take on this. So I've seen a lot of reports, I think we will have, that say that basically a more diverse teams have better outcomes, right? But why women specifically? That's one. And the second one is, I know that when I was back in my, many, many years ago, when I was in college, one of the arguments on campus was that if you had more women leaders, women as leaders, there would be fewer wars. But that actually isn't borne out by the literature. And I wonder whether this argument also that more women could lead to a more stable, more recession-proof economy is also flawed and kind of based on some flawed assumptions.
Yeah, so I have a couple points I want to make. So first of all, diversity in of itself does not actually increase performance. So the studies that we have seen, they talk about well-managed diversity. So a non-toxic and diverse workforce can have those higher outcomes in terms of better financial returns, and better risk management performance. So that's one thing. So just having a diverse team in of itself does not fix things. And then secondly, to Steve's point, women are people. And people make bad decisions quite frequently. The reason I think women are often considered to have these like saintly personas is only because we haven't had enough power to abuse it yet. So our time will come, get ready, and we will be just as dumb as men.
Make as many bad choices as men do.
Just
absolutely.
As accomplished, just as
true
dumb,
equality.
Just as petty, and just as wonderful. That because women are fundamentally people. So I really don't want women to get tasked with being kind of these angel saviors coming in and saving the men, because I don't actually think that that's the dynamic. That said, I absolutely agree with Christine Lagarde, and I think the rest of my co-hosts, that any well-managed organization is going to find a way to actively solicit people who think differently, have different key concerns, areas of expertise, and wrestle. And it is wrestling, right? When you don't agree, when you have fundamentally different outcomes that you'd prefer, when one of you wants to spend and one of you wants to save, whatever it is, you got to wrestle with it and come up with your plan from there. And I actually think that that's one of the biggest benefits that firms can get out of this. They have to test their thinking and their assumptions against the other people inside the organization. So I'm certainly very hopeful that...
And if there's groupthink, then there's nobody testing. There's
exactly.
Nobody going against.
Right. I mean, right. You know, coming to one of the companies that I just love to beat up on, you know, Facebook would have been better served by having very senior people who were placed inside the company who really cared about who owns this data, who's got access to this data, what does it look like when it goes wrong? They didn't have that. They had people inside the organization who cared about that stuff, but they were not elevated enough, and they did not have conversations with people who had the power around decision-making and strategy, and now look at where they are. Sure, they're still making tons of money, but the eyes are on them, and the trust is gone. So, you know, I think that's one fairly recent example that shows why organizations actually really need to work hard to find people who haven't already drunk the Kool-Aid, to use a very overused cliche.
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, just to diversity for its own sake. Like you were saying, it makes good business sense. So many times, there's tons of examples where products have been created without considering, you know, half of the population.
Remember that startup Bodega, the cashier
list? Oh, yeah. I love that. Right. Absolutely. A beloved institution in New York. Sure, let's just disrupt. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
Insane. So diversity, not just male-female, but cultural respecting other countries and knowing what it's about. Whereas if you have maybe three tech bros to pick on them together, they might not realize the implications of what they're doing.
And right. By the same token, you might have three privacy freaks, you know, people who agree with me. Well, you don't want me necessarily making all the choices for your product either.
We want you, just not three of you making all the choices.
Yeah. One is enough. Yeah.
We can only listen to one.
Well, that's exactly, you know, that makes sense with your point, is that it's a process, it's a discussion, it's an argument. And if that's happening, then that might be a good sign that your fintech, your firm, is going through a healthy process. And if you're all agreeing, and it's all smooth, you might be happier, but not realizing what mistakes you're making.
Yes, your comfort is not the mark of the quality of the decision.
Much like a healthy democracy.
Yes.
Some healthy, respectful discussion and back and forth, and seeing different sides is a definitely a big plus, and
that's so quaint.
Could have avoided a lot of issues in a lot of fintechs, not just Bodega.
I would actually like to know a little bit more, and I could certainly do the research in terms of what are the real pain points in terms of kind of these demographic markers of diversity in financial services. So obviously, we know that we don't see as many women in senior positions as they perhaps should be based on the population. I suspect that you probably have an overrepresentation, certainly in the U.S., of Asian Americans mm-hmm. compared to, say, African American or
but it's
Hispanic,
a pipeline
Latino.
Issue. I'm making quotes here, but it's a pipeline issue, of course. Yeah.
But I think that would be another interesting lens to look at these comments. You know, like, would you have some of the same lending practices at some of the big banks that they're consistently getting in trouble for the way they market and provide crappier loan options to low-income mm-hmm. communities? Would you see that if you had leaders who kind of looked like those communities? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So it might be too strong to say that a financial crisis would have completely been averted then. as Christine Lagarde implies. She says that if it was Lehman's sisters, then maybe there wouldn't have been such a big problem.
That made my eye roll.
That's cute. That's
no,
cute.
That yeah, made yeah. both my eyes roll. Yeah.
So she might be trying to make a strong point to make up for the fact of that there's a lack of other women like her in top positions like that. So our next article is about Ripple. Now, I like to see articles about implementations, actual production implementations of blockchain technology, because, I'm tired of seeing the proof of concept article.
Mm-hmm.
So Ripple, but I'm going to hedge on this one a little bit because it does seem a little bit sketchy, the way they made this announcement. Sorry, Ripple. But they hinted, they didn't make a direct announcement that they would be coming out with a new product called XRapid, based on their blockchain technology to do international payments. Instead, they said it may come out, we may have an announcement next month or so. And so that caused the price of Ripple to bounce about 20%. It's around 32.5 cents right now from 26, 27 cents where it was. So the blockchain news sites have been actually a little bit skeptical, and rightly so, based on that. So one, the title of one article is called XRP Price Surge, Buy the Rumor, Sell the News, in acknowledgement that this is this looks kind of manipulative the way they're making this announcement.
Well, even if it's legit, it's still quite a tease. We may have an announcement.
In the next month or so, you'll see some good news. So, and they don't give a lot of detail because it's not the announcement, I guess, but, you know, who they're working with, what financial institutions, what kind of volumes and performance and that sort of thing. So it does seem a little bit, something that might not be legal for a public company to do. Hello, Elon Musk.
Stop tweeting. I was just thinking the same thing. And what if 3 months from now, no announcement has come out? Would this be something where the SEC might want to go in and take a look and see if who the high and the mighty and the connected in the Ripple world
well,
who sold?
This isn't the first time that someone's done this, or yeah. just Ripple. So that's true with Ethereum, with a lot of the blockchain currencies. So, and they don't get regulated still the same way that, and it's not clear that they should be, the same way that equities are, mm-hmm. like stocks. But what
is clear is that the old adage, caveat emptor, should apply.
Yes.
As yeah. always. Yeah.
Yeah, I wish we could see who's buying and selling. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe some disclosure on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully the XRapid product does come out and a lot of blockchain projects and become production. So I'd like to see that part of it. But without a lot of the, it's a little bit sensitive now with the fraud that's going on with a lot of the new tokens, the ICOs that are coming out. And so we want to see the market grow up, develop, mature, and actually do production instead of kind of bouncing the market up and down.
Yeah.
So.
Buy the rumor, sell the news.
That's right. So good luck out there.
Good luck. Good luck.
So our last article is on Facebook. Our favorite social media company, is it, Monica?
I know. I'm hard on you, FB. But you deserve it. So this is a brief Wall Street Journal article that really follows up on something that we covered here a few weeks ago. So Facebook has been trying very hard and for a number of years to get financial data that passes through Messenger. So a number of banks, Amex, Wells Fargo, lots of others are spoken of in this article. They have had extended negotiations with Facebook over the years in terms of who actually owns your financial data when you are communicating with your bank or with a vendor through Facebook Messenger. So not a whole lot here that's new, just a little more context and color.
I was happy to see in the article at least that a lot of the banks and credit card companies were pushing back against Facebook.
Yes.
And if they let Facebook have their way, it sounds like they would have just taken it all. And that was the default setting. until they got a lot of pushback and negative press.
Yeah, so originally Facebook, it sounds like they were pretty aggressively pushing the line that they own anything that passes through their servers. So if you communicated with your bank through through Messenger, Facebook would own that data. Now, Facebook has a couple of really key reasons to want as much data on you as it can get,
I think it's the Google MasterCard thing.
They want to target ads to you, and they want those ads to be relevant, and they want to do that because it's profitable for them, but they also want to keep you engaged. They want to keep you on the site. So higher quality ads and the more time you spend on the site is the best thing that they can do for their business.
You have an agreement. You have to go get your bank statements and notifications on Facebook. I mean, that would be their dream, right?
That would be their dream. They would love that.
Get all through there,
And as you pointed out, John, to their credit, the banks really pushed back on this. It sounds like pretty uniformly, banks would not agree that this data was owned by Facebook.
Yay, the banks.
Yay, the banks.
They're the good guys in this story.
In this
story. Saying Facebook is so bad, the banks are the good guys.
The banks are better, yeah.
Okay.
You're saying that. Facebook eventually backed down and didn't try to press the point that they owned the data. But nonetheless, I would say that it's probably the case that the banks are trying to make themselves look good and leaking some of these details to.
This is like saying anybody that crosses in front of my house, I own your image and all the information that happens in front of your house, right?
Yeah, and it is interesting as well that a Facebook spokesperson did report back to the Wall Street Journal that Facebook hasn't and doesn't use consumer financial data for ad targeting. So, hasn't and doesn't equal won't.
I saw where that was going, yeah.
Well, I wasn't trying to, like, keep it in suspense, but, you know, just something to think about. So if you want to read this article and see what your bank said, your bank may very well be quoted in here.
Be in there, yeah.
If it's a credit union, probably not. You know, we'll keep an eye on this because I continue to question the legality of banks releasing your financial data to a firm like Facebook, which is not a subsidiary, not an affiliate.
Yeah, and that has impacts on, you know, not just Facebook and these particular banks, but how a lot of fintechs or social firms are using data. So if you're running some financial services think about protecting your client's data and how it gets used.
And, you know, if you think, again, what would Facebook like? Facebook would probably like for Steve not to show us his FICO score, but to show us his FB score. And if they can harness your personal network, your professional network, which they can do if you work for a company that uses Facebook Work, and your financial network.
Your purchases, your balances, everything, where you spend your money. I also wonder where this could be used to sort of augment their profiles they have and people they can sell to advertisers as well.
Oh,
to say,
they haven't and don't use such data for ad targeting.
As of yesterday.
But I wonder if Google is doing this, obviously, through the MasterCard purchase, why isn't Facebook doing this now?
I have a lot of questions about what Google is doing with MasterCard's data anyway. So I don't know the answer to your question. It frankly unnerves the heck out of me. And if we had a functioning Congress, I feel like there'd be hearings on this.
There's always hearings.
Right now,
who's listening though?
Hey, listen. Right now, I'll take people under subpoena having to answer questions. But then, of course, I remember that the last time I watched the Senate ask questions of technology professionals,
how does Facebook make money? Was a question.
Can you help me clear my cookies?
How can I change it to chocolate chip cookies?
Yeah.
I do think we probably could use some more technologically literate representatives.
Yeah, when they went to Europe, they had a team of professionals, experts in that field, question Facebook rather than...
Mm-hmm. Which is why the questions were much better, more probing, more actually like relevant as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now if you have Orrin Hatch asking, you know, again, how does Facebook make money or all this stuff, it's not a really pretty picture.
It looks kind of silly
it looks,
compared to a team of experts or some technical people.
Right. Well, Europeans do value technocratic expertise, or at least they used to.
Yeah, thanks. That's an interesting point and something we have to think about across the financial industry. And now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it.
My final bite is $550 billion.
I think that's the largest final bite this week, isn't it?
I think it very well may be. And that's the total size of the U.S. market for CLOs. CLOs, of course, stand for collateralized loan obligations, which is sort of a callback to our Great Recession theme and the fact that we had all this CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. So kind of a slightly different name for a similar product. One key issue here is that these CLOs are now being marketed towards retail investors. So you can now own a piece of somebody's loan, kind of own a tranche of that, mm-hmm. based on the rating, of course. So good times ahead.
Yeah, if you're selling to retail investors, that must be the best possible deal you can get, right?
I think that's the last
you
sucker.
You keep the good
mind.
Loans. Yeah. And they get handed down.
The triple B or whatever, the junk rated stuff.
The final tranche goes out to retail. Great returns.
Yeah.
If you can get them. Huh. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a huge number. And just another one of those risk factors for the next financial crisis of 2019. All right.
I'll go next. My final bite is $6.2 billion. And this is the amount that MasterCard and Visa have agreed to settle with merchants. So we have talked earlier about a pretty much a class action lawsuit that merchants across the U.S. had brought against Visa and MasterCard. Merchants wanted to negotiate with banks directly as to what fee a merchant would pay to run that customer's credit card through. And Visa and MasterCard got in there like good old middlemen do and said, nah, you're going to pay the fee that we say you're going to pay. So they have a settlement for this. But I wouldn't say that the merchants really won because the status quo still remains.
Yeah, they lost a quarter of profit, yeah?
They did, and it's worth actually noting here that a lot of the big merchants in the U.S. actually opted out of the lawsuit. It's mostly small merchants now. So Walmart is not in there. Best Buy is not in there as well. So because they can, they have enough power.
Yeah, they
have enough power to basically negotiate a lower fee than a mom and pop store would. So The little guy gets screwed.
So, but that's an interesting thing to think about too. Like when you think about like Square, right, where they're focusing on small businesses. I wonder if Square would ever get to a position where they had enough bargaining power with a Visa and a MasterCard to negotiate lower rates. That may not even be on the radar. I don't know.
If they get big enough, maybe.
Huh. It sounds like what you were saying before. As soon as you get into power, then you can do the abuse. So my final bite is $2.6 billion. This is the amount that's estimated to be the post-IPO valuation for Funding Circle, which should have its IPO in the next few weeks.
It's a unicorn.
It's a unicorn. Welcome. Yeah. No, it has been recognized as a unicorn.
2.6 unicorn.
That's right. And it's the largest IPO since Adyen, at least in Europe, which was a Dutch payment processor, which has doubled its IPO price since it went public in June. Now, Funding Circle's business model hasn't done as well in the public markets. OnDeck Capital and Lending Club are both below their 2014 offering prices. So not positive that this one will work out as well, since it hasn't shown to be really proven yet, has it?
This also comes at the heel of Wanga basically collapsing in the UK. So I wonder whether, there seems to be no market for this at all.
Amidst Brexit uncertainty, which could potentially bisect their market, but apparently Adyen made it work for a year.
Yeah, so far. And Funding Circle is not making money. They're losing money still. So, they'll use this capital to keep expanding and marketing in their major markets in the UK and in the United States. So good luck to Funding Circle. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or anything you'd like to hear on the podcast, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. The links to the articles that we discussed are in the show notes. And thank you for listening.
Until next week.
Bye.